to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Hello, Zero Books viewers and readers. This is another live stream edition of the Zero Squared podcast. With me today is Julian Hanna. He's an assistant professor at Madeira's Interactive Technologies Institute in Portugal, and he writes extensively about the modern and contemporary avant-garde movements. In his book, The Manifesto Handbook, came out in February of this year. So I'm glad to have a chance to talk to you today, Julian, about manifestos. I feel as though there's a need for a new one. Thanks for coming on the live stream.
Yeah, thanks for having me. We definitely need more.
I think maybe one of the things that we might find ourselves in disagreement about is whether or not we need a plurality of manifestos, or whether or not we need a new, strong, you know, communist manifesto.
Yeah. Umbrella manifesto.
Yeah. Sure. So your book is very interesting. It's a lot of fun. And it approaches, I would say, it approaches the manifesto rather lightly, and as an exercise in style and aesthetics as much as in political policy making. How do you think the manifesto became a literary genre?
I guess you'd have to go back to the kind of aftermath of the Communist Manifesto. That's usually where you start. If you don't go all the way back to Moses or something, they say Moses, Marx, and Marinetti. If we go back to Marx, then kind of in the late 19th century in Europe, particularly there started to crop up these kind of literary variations on the political form. It's important to know that the manifesto goes back much further than that, or at least a couple of centuries further than that. But it's kind of the revolutionary form that we're usually talking about when we talk about manifestos, whether it's literature, art, or politics. So,
are you there?
There.
Okay. Now I think I fixed it.
Okay, that's good.
Someone's telling me in the chat again that I'm a little bit quiet, so I'm looking at my gain. I think that this is about as good as it's going to get, and as I said last night, I'll fix it in post. But continue. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah. Kind of around maybe like the late 19th century, with the aesthetes. You know, when I was studying that period, I did a PhD on manifestos, so that kind of it was a lot heavier before it got lighter with this book. I was looking at people like Oscar Wilde, you know, or with kind of pronouncements about aestheticism, like the preface to Dorian Gray, or there was a manifesto of what was it? There were all kinds, yeah, in the 1880s, 1890s, and then it was really 1909 is kind of the other important date for art and literature, with the first Futurist Manifesto, and from there it kind of opened the floodgates and everything. It's kind of been going in waves ever since, to continue the water metaphor.
Did it happen because artists began to flood into the political realm and started to see their project as being more aimed at social change rather than institutional expression, maybe, or the continuation of a tradition? I mean, did the manifesto become a literary genre because art was transformed along with everything else politically? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think you just cut out a little bit there, but I think it's kind of the romanticism, I guess. It's romanticism and revolution. That was something I left out from the earlier 19th century. So, so someone like Oscar Wilde even would have been maybe thinking of the earlier the poets as legislators of the world. You know, like Shelley's phrase. unacknowledged legislators. So there's kind of that married to this political revolution. But it's not always, it kind of manifested in different ways. So there was, on the one hand, even someone like Oscar Wilde, who was, seemed pretty apolitical, was writing, like, he wrote one called The Poets and the People, that was kind of sort of a socialist manifesto and The Soul of Man Under Socialism. But then on the other hand, he wrote the preface to Dorian Gray, which was kind of trying to separate art from politics. And similarly, James McNeill Whistler, who was living in London and debating Oscar Wilde, was writing proto-manifestos that were totally about art. And they were saying things like only artists should be allowed to go to museums. So kind of keeping a strict line there and very far from political, revolutionary political screeds. But then with someone like Marinetti in the early 20th century, there was clearly, although it wasn't kind of political propaganda, there was clearly he was clearly playing the game of doing something in the artistic realm that was very close to what was going on in the streets. And people have written about how in those years leading up to the First World War, it was just kind of a free-for-all of suffragettes and vorticists and futurists. And there was, and then that was all kind of cut short by the war for quite a while afterwards. There's a lot of overlap, in other words.
It almost seems to me that the move from the manifesto as an introduction to a political platform and a declaration of an intention for social and political change to something more like literary expression of maybe resistance or protest, but without a rational, without being attached to a rational plan for action, that this represents a kind of revolutionary move, maybe what you're describing is it's that the manifesto became part of a romantic reaction against Enlightenment, maybe Marxist or socialist politics. Mm-hmm. You think that's true?
Yeah. In a sense, it was very romantic because, of course, manifestos are very loose. They're not particularly rational. They're not really an Enlightenment texts. They're all in for the struggle, whether that's artistic or political. Very, very much comes from that wing. And then, of course, it didn't. It was kind of a blossoming into every possible, into every aspect of life, rather than kind of the artist taking over from the socialists or something. It was kind of everyone was going for it, and soon you had this manifestos about every aspect of life, from cooking to kind of like now, you have people doing you have Goop manifesto. Gwyneth Paltrow is issuing manifestos, and the right and left are issuing manifestos, and you have manifestos for business and every possible thing. So it's fire hose kind of thing.
So in the Communist Manifesto was written just before the revolutions of 1848. And during that time, there was, a real political social transformation rolling across Europe. It sounds like what you're describing as the trajectory of the manifesto in the 20th century is a kind of a move away from that model where basically the idea that expression and desire could become a rationally planned form of life and therefore activity was tossed aside, and it became something more like pure expression and or something like instrumental instructions, because if you have a manifesto for cooking or manifesto cleaning your house or something, then that's certainly lowering your horizons in terms of what you can
accomplish. It's hard to talk about the manifesto. Maybe that's why the book ended up being so fragmented. It was originally intended to be a kind of straight handbook, and then it kind of split into 95 different theses because it is a lot to cover. There are a lot of different kinds of manifestos. but maybe it's good to, it would be good to lay out a couple of basic strains because they're very different. There are the there's the list of rules kind of manifesto, right? Like you had the in the 90s, there was the Lars von Trier's Dogma Manifesto, if you remember, and it was kind of a very straightforward. Well, it was tongue in cheek, but it was kind of do this, 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 and this, and you'll be part of our club. This was, you know, straight list of rules. And then there's the kind of more of a rousing call to action kind of manifesto. And then on the other hand, there's a statement of principles that doesn't really seem to call for followers directly. It's more like, this is what we believe, X, Y, and Z. Finally, then there's the kind of Dadaist bomb-throwing manifesto that just wants to blow everything apart and see where it, see where it all lands. So you can see that it's hard to talk about one thing called the manifesto. Although there's a lot of shared, there's a lot of common ground. Oh, I lost you there.
Let's see, is this better?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So that button. So while we were talking, somebody asked me if I would upload the, this as a podcast, and I will, and that will also mean that I can correct whatever audio issues there are.
Great.
So let's talk about some of the nitty-gritty of your book here. Like, one of the things that you mention is that Tristan Tzara, the Dadaist, developed some rules for writing a manifesto.
Mm-hmm.
And your book was, as you said, was originally intended to be kind of along those same lines. You were going to be providing a handbook, and if not absolutely hard and fast rules, then at least some strong suggestions as to how to write a manifesto. How close did you end up being to Tristan Tzara's and his list of rules? I mean, I imagine his rules, I haven't read that, or at least if I have, it's been a long enough time, I don't remember. But I imagine his rules didn't make a lot of linear sense. What were his rules? Can you remember some of
them? Well, I've actually got, this is a very good anthology for some of the biggies from kind of art and literature. Mm-hmm. And it's the Dada Manifesto of 1918 is in there. And he does lay out some rules. I'll just skip quickly through a few of them and you'll get the flavor for what kinds of rules he was laying down. He says, to put out a manifesto, you must want ABC to fulminate against 1, 2, 3, fly into a rage and sharpen your wings to conquer and disseminate little ABCs and big ABCs to sign, shout, swear, to organize prose into a form of absolute and irrefutable evidence. So that all sounds like a straightforward manifesto, right? Muster your forces in a form of absolute and irrefutable evidence. And then he says, to impose your ABC is a natural thing, hence deplorable. So this is where the contradictions start to pop up. So he's saying, okay, he says all this, this is how you write a manifesto. And then he sort of says, and it's a deplorable act, the imposition of the will. And this is something that manifestos always wrestle with, is the authority versus rebellion, right? They're kind of, they want to impose the will and they also want to rebel against it. And in this case, he sort of in real time is rebelling against his own imposition of will. So he says, I write a manifesto and I want nothing. Yet I say certain things, and in principle, I am against manifestos, as I am also against principles. Helpful. He says, I write this manifesto to show that people can perform contrary actions together. I'm against action, for continuous contradiction, for affirmation, two, I'm neither for nor against, and I don't explain because I hate common sense. So it sounds like a mess of contradictions, and then you realize that it's actually a perfect manifesto because it's a perfect embodiment or description of what data is. So, and that's kind of the key to manifestos. It's not necessarily that you have to you can state explicitly that we are this, this, and this, but you can also kind of embody it the same way that, yeah, a lot of, I think especially artistic manifestos do, that they, yeah, they show rather than telling, I guess. And that's what he's doing there.
I sometimes think of Dada as a romantic rejection of this communist movement that was going on, you know, in the early 20th century and that had risen up in the 19th century. Not only of the communist turn, but of, as I said before, like the Enlightenment Project, this progressive strain of European politics, and mm-hmm. a retreat into romanticism and irrationality, and you know, in response to the First World War and the failures of all these Enlightenment projects. And then the Surrealist movement, which came after, I see more as a struggling after a return to socialism, struggling to be part of a political revolution again. Do you think that's a fair characterization of those two movements?
Yeah, definitely. Breton's Surrealism, obviously, he was, you know, embraced socialism and communism. Even Stalinism. The Dadaists were a bit messier, as you kind of expect from Dadaists. So Zara was one thing, but then there was Berlin Dada slightly later, just after the First World War, and that was much more political, maybe as you'd expect from Berlin versus Zurich. The kind of absurdity of It's hard to separate it from the First World War, as you say, that it was very much a response to that carnage. So maybe less a reaction to communism and more, yeah, but definitely a rebellion against the Enlightenment Project, which had been shown to be so bankrupt. Mm-hmm.
And do you feel like we're back in a Dadaist mode when it comes to manifesto writing today? That explains the plurality of and the individuality of all these different manifestos that are being generated, at least to some degree.
Mm-hmm. Maybe. Yeah, we were definitely there at the end of the 20th century. There was a movement called Neoism, and that was kind of very, and then of course punk as well. You know, there were some kind of late Dada movements. Now, I don't know if I would call it Dada. There's definitely a new wave of manifesto writing. Some of it, though, is very, very kind of straightforward activist. You know, obviously, an Antifa manifesto isn't like, or a Black Lives Matter manifesto isn't particularly Dada. So you have to separate out the different strains. But maybe the more nihilistic streak that Zara's Dadaism was very nihilistic, so maybe you're seeing some of that for sure.
Yeah. So the new manifestos that are coming up in the 21st century are reverting to form. They're written by committees or groups. They have clear political aims. That's what you're saying, I guess. And they're less a matter of kind of radical avant-garde expression now.
There's some of that too. There's always everything. But there's definitely an upswell or a return in the last, I'd say, 10 years, or actually 12 years, maybe since 2008, with the financial crisis. You really saw a return to the kind of manifesto, a kind of unabashed activism that was pretty out of fashion when I first started reading manifestos. It was, you know, people were kind of still doing the Dada thing, but staying away from the sincere kind of politics.
Do you think maybe because you say something really interesting in your book, which is that we're all almost writing manifestos when we tweet. Am I mischaracterizing that?
No, that's my argument. Yeah. That's what I think of every time I'm on Twitter too much. And that's what I think of every time I'm on there, is that the way that we, sharpen these little kind of pronouncements for maximum effect, And the way that we're also conditioned, you know, by the platform to sharpen them and make them as provocative as possible and as hard hitting. And then, of course, the combination of text and images. They're very manifesto like.
So maybe what's happened is that, you know, NGOs and activist organizations and real political movements of various types have taken up the old style communist manifesto style, I'll say, approach. And then Dada has moved online and onto social media.
Sure. Yeah. That sounds about right.
Yeah. So that's an interesting. So that's another reason to quit Twitter or to embrace it fully, depending on your election, I suppose. Well, in a minute or two, maybe in about more like 20 minutes, I want to give people an opportunity to ask some questions. But before we do that, I want to give you a chance to rewrite your own manifesto. And by that, I mean the actual text is expressive and emotive and a lot of fun. And I'm going to come through in a dull way and ask you to transform your descriptions or your 95 steps towards the proper manifesto into something pedestrian.
So, okay. Go for it.
Just that only because I know my own limitations here. If we go through your pieces, the 95 steps, let's say, call it, your first step is that you have to proclaim a manifesto. That is, in order to do that, you have to,
say the
thunder against 1, 2, 3, lose your patience and sharpen your wings. To conquer and spread ABC's little and big sign, scream, swear, arrange the prose in a form of absolute and irrefutable evidence.
I better get one of these.
And so now I'm going to try to make that pedestrian. Maybe you have to find.
You're just doing the data manifesto there. So that was simple.
That's all there is here, right? And that's your first step is a quote from the data manifesto. Yeah. And the second step is. Comment on the Communist Manifesto, but
that's right.
So I'm thinking that you put this here as a way to say you have to break beyond the systems of thought that are already in the world and explode that out and to discover your own desire and your own proclamation, your own expression. Yeah, so you have to go beyond the present and go beyond the ABCs and 1, 2, 3s, as the Dadaists would put it, and break through the system that you're in as a first step.
Sure, yeah.
So if that's the case, you probably have to do a lot of pre-manifesto work, right? A lot of...
Right, the manifesto is the tip of the iceberg, right? You have to... it comes out to be a page, but there's a lot, hopefully, beneath that.
Right. So a lot of perhaps activist work, theoretical work, artistic expression, who knows what kind of experimentation is going on in the background behind the first line of that manifesto.
Yeah. I mean, an easy way of thinking about it is I always try to remind people that a manifesto is a kind of advertisement for ideas. So if you're boiling a complex, a big complex movement into 10 points, you're kind of digesting it so that it's understandable for a wide audience. And you're also kind of selling a little bit. So that's where the advertisement comes in. And there's usually a bit of nice graphic design to go along with it.
Right.
It shouldn't be a dull screed. Usually the long dull screeds are where you get into trouble. At the beginning of the book, the first, 10 or 20 of these were kind of descriptions of kind of parts of the manifesto. Like I put the Zara in there at the beginning because it's such a nice description. It's such an influential one. Then I had to go to the Communist Manifesto and talk about the narrative, you know, a specter is haunting Europe, kind of telling a bit of a story in the manifesto and so on.
Yeah. So yeah, the second one is you have to determine after you've explored or explained or made your exclamation, you know, found your expression, you proclaimed your point of view that's breaking through the system. Now you have to develop a story to explain that first proclamation, right? And to set your new desires into a context.
Right, and make them, you know, sweep people up in the story. It's a great story to, I mean, the Communist Manifesto, it conjures this, it starts with this ghost story of the specter of communism sweeping Europe, but it also sets up a kind of opposition that you can fight against. And it's, and you just kind of want to throw yourself into it. So that's, yeah, it's a selling tactic to reduce it to something much less than it actually is, maybe.
Right. Well, in the case of the Communist Manifesto, they were trying to eke out a position in the new revolutionary movements of that were coming up to become the revolutions of 1848.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. And there was they were sort of riding the coattails of bourgeois Republican revolutions. And claiming, you know, look, every side hates this new power that's emerging alongside the bourgeois Republican power, although they didn't put it quite like this. But the point was they were staking a claim for power and authority and the ability to transform society in a moment where there really was a specter haunting Europe. A feeling of disease and chaos brewing. And, you know, the most radical elements of those revolutions were the socialists and the communists and the working class movements. Right. So it wasn't a story in so much as it was a lie, but it was a way of contextualizing their manifesto and what their demands would be.
Mm-hmm.
I did a little podcast about the manifesto and reread it. And one of the things that's interesting about the manifesto is that if you compare it to the way people imagine communism to be today, in other words, after, say, the Soviet experiment and its failure, after Lenin, the Communist Manifesto has a lot of pretty reformist, milquetoast demands in it. That many of them were realized, even suffrage, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So
I'm not sure I would call it milquetoast, but
well, in comparison to the radical demands for from let's say from inside the surrealist imaginary, their milquetoast demands, right?
Right.
And yet in the context of that moment, they were conceived of as being the most radical of demands that could be expressed, were part of the movement of, that became, communism, as it went along. So I don't know, I just pointed that out. It's like, one of the things that is important about, I guess, a manifesto and the story that you're telling is not so much the individual pieces taken in isolation, but is indeed that story.
Mm-hmm.
So they're more that maybe that story is more important than the demands that are in the manifesto. Do you think?
Yeah. And then you see how, when people talk about the Communist Manifesto, they're usually not talking about, I can't remember all the sections, but the, those kind of fairly dull, let's be honest, sections later on, the third section or whatever.
Banking and stuff like that.
It's not all quite as exciting as the beginning and the end.
So
bits of it kind of fall away and other bits come forward and are kind of honed, with time, smoothed a bit. And as you say, we don't remember all of the demands that were part of the contemporary scene. The other interesting thing you talk about how they were jostling with these other kind of competing movements or voices, that's a big part of it. A big part of the function of the manifesto is to kind of, as it was before the First World War with the avant-gardes, they were all kind of jostling loudly against each other, and that's where the volume kind of amps up with these manifestos, and that's where Dada suddenly rises to this kind of screaming pitch.
So your third thesis here is just called Up All Night.
Yeah.
And so does that mean, what do you mean by, does that mean you have to work hard, or you have to break your usual pattern, or what? Why up all night?
I'm speed reading it now. I know that it was important to get futurism right there in the first three as well. There's Dada and Marx, and now there's Marinetti. Let's see. I mean, the founding and manifesto of futurism was the one that kind of launched A Thousand Imitators. The preamble, similarly to the Communist Manifesto, the preamble is very important as this energizing story. I guess it carries on from the second thesis because it's talking about a narrative. So the founding and manifesto of futurism is amazing because it's not for the tenets that come later. It's for the story that they tell in the beginning. It starts out, "We'd stayed up all night, my friends and I, under hanging mosque lamps with domes of filigreed brass, domes starred like our spirits, shining like them with the prison radiance of electric hearts." It's pretty way out prose, and it's not the kind of just simple, "We must do this, 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 and this." It tells a real story, and it kind of, again, is kind of encapsulating the movement and the passion of the movement, the romantic passion of the movement in the prose. It also kind of shows that they weren't as futurist as they might have let on. It's kind of going back to the turn of the century, and it's kind of Marinetti's letting on the kind of symbolist poet he actually is at heart, with these mosque lamps and this exoticism. But anyway, yeah, he's telling another story in the preamble, and again, trying to get people excited, worked up, and then he hits them with the tenets later on about destroying the museums and flooding the libraries.
And in that vein, your next suggestion is that you have to grab the reader's attention. Mm-hmm. And you point to the futurists again as having a particularly well-developed knack for inspiring engagement from the audiences.
I mean, Marinetti, the leader of the movement, was just a master kind of PR guy and storyteller and spin master. So this was they put into one of their manifestos. They wrote like, I don't know, hundreds of them maybe. Mm-hmm. Over a couple of decades, but this is still right at the beginning of the movement. It's a futurist painting manifesto. And he starts out with a violent brawl that took place at their first manifesto. So they launched the first manifesto, have all these kind of brawls and public events that get splashed on the papers. And then in the next manifesto, he writes about the reaction to the first manifesto, thus kind of building this myth right into the manifesto itself. And he talks about how this brawl broke out and with students and artists how they exchanged fists and ideas and so on, mixing this kind of street violence and ideas.
And then just to skip ahead a couple, one of them here is number six is we. Mm-hmm. It goes back to something we've already discussed, but the difference between the manifesto as an expression of a political will, maybe, or a group will, and as a personal expression. Mm-hmm. And I think you seem to be siding with the idea that we should, if you're writing a manifesto, it should be part of a collective effort. That it, mm-hmm. it
yeah, and that conversely, the I quote the historian Eric Hobsbawm talking about how manifestos used to always been, as he knew them in the 20th century, they were always collective, proclamations. Right. And he said, it strikes me now, he says that it's so many of them are individual statements. This was in 2008. Mm-hmm. and that the Wii was kind of dissolving. And I would kind of venture to that he was thinking about the atomization of society and kind of the, you know, breaking up of collective movements. And so you end up, it's kind of a reflection of the society that we're living in. Now, whether you still write manifestos and use the Wii, it's another matter, because a lot of manifestos, I mean, the Communist Manifesto wasn't written by committee. It was written by a couple of guys
but they had asked him to write.
They talked to others. Yeah.
Yeah, the Communist League put him in that position to write it. And then they revised it after. There was a revised Communist Manifesto. So, I think that's an important point. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the problems that we might be running up against on the left is the difficulty in which we have in finding the we. I mean, I keep finding it. But whenever I will often encounter people online when I'm ranting critiques of we or the left, right? Like I'll post, the problem with the left today is blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. You know, we all need to get in line with what I think. That's what I often will end up saying on Facebook. People will rightly say, well, who are you talking about? What mm-hmm. is this left? Who is this we?
Right.
The breaking up of a strong left socialist, say, identity or subjectivity or political force, to put mm-hmm. it more strongly still, I think might be another reason why it became the manifesto became a genre of that was not so far away from the confession.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I think that was something Mark Fisher talked about, wasn't it? This kind of splintering of the left into, I mean, I guess the left is splintered at different times throughout its history, but failure to kind of cohere in a common for a common cause. On the other hand, I like to be optimistic and say that there are a lot of, maybe since Hobsbawm said this in 2008, that there's actually been, with all the upheaval and economic crisis and so forth, and return of socialism, even in the U.S., that over the past 12 years there's been more of the we. I hope. I mean, there's also there's the splintering, but there's maybe more collective activism and then manifestos as a result than there were in the decades prior.
Well, I certainly hope that you're right. So you've got the handbook you've written here. Are you going to write your own manifesto, or better yet, are you going to work with others to write one? You think?
I write all the time. Yeah. There's even one. There's one in the book, but I churn them out from time to time. I wrote a lockdown manifesto last week. So,
what's your most recent manifesto?
That would probably be a lockdown manifesto. It was kind of more of a poem, which was kind of veering into strange and dangerous territory, but it was kind of trying to put the thoughts together about how we can make sense of and react to this strange pause where we kind of, we have an opportunity, which is real, I think. You know, there's never been an opportunity like this to kind of remake society. There's never been such a disruption in the past, I don't know.
Since 1918.
Yeah, sure. Or maybe the Second World War, but not for a long time. But on the other hand, of course, it seems like an awkward time to.
You're breaking up a little bit.
Yeah. Okay. It's hard to rally people when there's so much kind of pain in the, I guess, that so many people are going through.
It's also hard to rally people when you meet up to rally. You can't actually meet
rally. That's a good reason to write manifestos, though. You know, they're action in words. Maybe we write the manifestos now and then we take to the streets maybe in the next couple of years.
Well, we've reached the 40-minute mark here in our conversation, and I thought now might be a good time to throw it to the people who are watching. We've got, you know, about 55 people watching, which isn't so bad for a Friday morning on the West Coast.
Good evening. And you're not drinking wine in the morning, by the way. It's, it's you know, about 8 o'clock in Portland.
Look, we're all doing what we can to get through the outbreak. I know that's you're... You probably have been drinking here. But I just want to throw it open to people who might want to ask some questions. But what I would ask you is, do you think that the lockdown and the kind of pausing that has of the whole world's economy that's happened will give people the opportunity to, I mean, because I think Zizek suggested this in his book in a way that I thought was uncharacteristically Pollyanna. It might give us an opportunity to do some rethinking and to do the kind of critical work that's necessary before you can find your way to express a desire for a new form of life that, you know, that before you can express true desire, maybe. Do you think do you see that happening in this moment, or are we just spiraling into, you know, disarray and delusion or both, or are those two things actually the same thing?
The jury's out. It could go either way. There are some encouraging signs. You know, a lot of people are coming out with manifestos now. I'm trying to think of some examples. There's a good manifesto series right now with City Lights Books, actually, in Gray Area, in the Bay Area. That was actually my most recent manifesto. I read something there. But there's a whole series running through the month of May. So that's a lot of manifestos. Bruno Latour, the French sociologist, he writes some good manifestos, and he kind of did a questionnaire manifesto, which was interesting. So instead of being, just recently he put it up on his website, so instead of being top down about it and saying we're going to do this, this, and this, he said, what do you want and not want the world to look like after this pandemic? So that was kind of an interesting way to, you know, kind of like a flipped classroom or something, like flipping the authority. But yeah, there are a lot of, you know, people are obviously, they have a bit of, if you're lucky not to be suffering too much, then you have some time to think, and things are going to look a lot different afterwards one way or the other. So might be a nice time to jump in and try to, you know, shape the future a bit.
Yeah, well, I feel as though the economic crisis is going to be coming, or is this really already here in many ways, will motivate people to write manifestos and hopefully go beyond that into actual political action and organizing to defend their interests. Because we're looking at something like 14% unemployment right now in the U.S. They're projecting up to 20 to 25% unemployment. And in those kinds of conditions, I would expect that people would start to try to imagine an alternative to their own destitution. And that might mean coming together and working together to defend their interests and you know, a new kind of working class movement. I'm really hopeful that that's what will happen.
I jumped in when you were breaking up.
Oh, that's okay. You saw that in 2008, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. When things got bad for several years, I was in Portugal. I arrived in October 2008, as fate would have it. So I arrived just in time to lose half my job that I'd traveled there for, and kind of see everyone losing jobs and getting huge cuts and taking to the streets. for the next 4 or 5 years, really. It went on a long time. So yeah, you did see a lot more activism because, you know,
it never really died down. I mean, the Yellow Vest movement in France could be seen as a continuation of the kind of uprisings that started after, like, around 2009, and just come up and peter out and come up and peter out. But this is going to be a deeper crisis than the 2008 crisis. So we'll maybe have a deeper political. I mean, that's very deterministic thinking in a way, but I mean,
no, it's hard not to see it as a pretty big chasm lurking, awaiting us after this spring.
But someone says, they're talking about Trump. someone's saying that the question is, will people go to the right, basically, rather than towards their own working class self-interest? Yeah. And that's always the question. Certainly, it didn't look good. The last 10 years, let's say, haven't been great in terms of that. Yeah. I'm not seeing any questions. If people wanted to throw a couple of super chats our way, that'd be great too. But you don't have to do a super chat in order to ask a question.
I would just say, like, about the people moving to the right. There's as in the 1930s, there's when the Depression, a lot of people moved to the left, obviously, but a lot of people also moved to the kind of Stalinist left or to fascism. And with a kind of nihilist attitude that I think is—I don't know—I'm living in Portugal, but I don't know if you see it there of a kind of dangerous nihilism taking hold amongst maybe young people that would be normally you would think of them as left, but of kind of losing a bit of hope and wanting to kind of just burn it down. And that's where it might get dangerous with. Someone like Trump. I don't know why anyone would go to Trump to solve that problem, but
someone just threw £5 our way, which is always nice to get pounds rather than dollars. It's a little bit more. They ask, would you ever debate someone who is openly racist, anti-Semitic, or holds other offensive ideas? And I think that's aimed at me, but we can both answer it. My answer is yes, and in fact, I have. I debated Stephen Molyneux not so long ago, and while he might try to hide or claim that he doesn't have racist views, I don't think that can be really defended that he doesn't. He's a race realist, and I didn't debate him on race. I debated him on whether or not Marxists were evil scum. Or something like that. So yeah, I would, and I don't think people should be afraid of debating racists or people with noxious views. I don't think you should invite them to your socialist meetings, or if you're putting on an event to talk about, organizing for your own interests or to put forward a certain message. You don't need to invite some bigot from the far right to debate with at that. But I don't think it's wrong to debate.
You don't have to love or even tolerate people to debate them on points. I find myself reading some pretty horrible manifestos because I want to do my homework. And I wrote in the book about some of the, nastier kinds of manifestos coming out from white nationalists or mass shooters who are dropping manifestos now at the scene of the crime. They don't make very pleasant reading, but I, had to dig in and read everything.
Do you have any thoughts on Gramsci's writings? And would you consider Gramsci to be writing in the area of the manifesto?
I like Gramsci. I don't know if I have anything. I like the prison writings. It's been a while. Definitely an influential figure on 20th century, 21st century, political manifestos, but I don't have anything specific, to say.
What about the dropping of these, like the Unabomber Manifesto and the, do you think that, I mean, obviously the manifesto is not only a tool of the left. I've been acting as though it was a progressive genre by definition, but it
sadly no.
Manifesto demonstrates that it isn't. Right. Do you think that critiquing the Unabomber or one of these guys like Elliot Rodger or someone like that as a writer of manifestos rather than strictly ideologically or politically will lead you anywhere? Is it the case that a progressive manifesto is better in genre terms, is better aesthetically?
I think so. I mean, if you've tried to trudge through Elliot Rodger or Anders Breivik, it's not very nice stuff. It's kind of, when I wrote about it in the book, it was just purely in kind of formal terms. They tend to be extremely long and kind of in turgid prose, and kind of I sort of came up with a theory that the longer the manifesto was, the more trouble you're in. Because it's, you know, it's someone who's kind of trying to beat you into submission with the heft of their manifesto. You know, I prefer manifestos that are a couple of pages long. And if you have to write, I mean, the Unabomber manifesto, that's on the kind of, you know, that's on the easier end.
Okay.
If you get into the hundreds of pages, and then they tend to be humorless, of course. So,
right.
You know, Valerie.
The Scum Manifesto you're about to talk about, but you're frozen up a little bit.
Oh, back?
You're back. Yeah, okay.
I was just going to say the I love the Scum Manifesto, and that doesn't mean I vouch for everything in it, but it's an exciting and... you know, there's a lot of stuff that's worth studying in it. Not necessarily. I mean, the ideas, yes, but also the writing itself. It's an interesting text, which isn't the same for extremist manifestos on all parts of the spectrum.
I think you're a simp, but that's okay. let's see here. So yeah, someone says that Unabomber was a significantly more intelligent person than Elliot Rodgers or Breivik.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. You can definitely, you can read the Unabomber Manifesto and get a lot out of it. And that, again, it's not an endorsement. It's not something I say in the introduction is that if you want to love and dive into manifestos, you kind of have to have, you can't be too easily offended. Even the good ones, because they're kind of extreme by nature, they tend to, you know, there are some amazing feminist manifestos that fall into eugenics or, you know, or like the Scum Manifesto, killing all men. And it's, you know, they're, you have to kind of take the crunchy with the smooth, I guess, if you're going to be appreciating anything from them. But yeah, something like the Unabomber Manifesto was some interesting ideas taken to extremes. And then obviously he overstepped is an understatement, but it's an example that's always present in the manifesto of there's always a tension between action, you know, real world action and rhetoric and violence. And that was obviously an example of if he'd written a kind of screed, you know, he might've published it with, you know, with a left wing publisher. And instead he sent, you know, nail bombs around to people.
So Professor Axis asks if we've done the Communist Manifesto yet. And the answer is, yeah, we discussed it early in the stream. Also, if you look through the old videos on our channel, there's a Pop the Left episode with Derek Varn where we spend an hour on the Communist Manifesto. And of course, you could go back and do more. Communist Manifesto is almost infinitely interesting. But yeah, we have talked about it. And I, of course, as a Marxist, would strongly, you know, suggest that as manifestos go, that's the best one. But I'm, you know, if I don't say that, comrades or get excommunicated or sent to Siberia.
It's pretty good. It holds up pretty well.
Yeah. Someone says Martin Luther's On the Jews was a horrible manifesto.
Mm.
Let's see if we have any more. The Frozen manifesto is thrown up. Do you know that? Is that from Disney's Frozen
movie?
I don't want to read that one.
I know that I just watched the latest Mission Impossible film, and it opened with a kind of Unabomber like, I don't know if you've seen it, but had a kind of Unabomber like baddie in it, and he was issuing a manifesto, and just like the Unabomber, he was kind of saying that they had to broadcast it. So that was kind of interesting for me. I stopped watching after that, but that was in the intro.
So someone's suggesting that we play Freebird.
Sure.
I think that's the at that point, that's the end of the stream when we devolved into people calling for Freebird.
At the end of the stream.
Yeah. But instead of Freebird, I'll play the out credits. And then what we'll do is in about a half an hour, come back on, record a second stream. Hopefully the sound issues will remain fixed, and this one will be for patrons only. So if you enjoy these conversations, support us on Patreon. But here's the out credits.
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
see... We still, to a large extent, live in the interregnum.